This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
In Kenya, seven officials from the Doctors' Union will be spending the next month behind bars for refusing to end the strike that has paralyzed the country's public health system for more than 2 months.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting from Nairobi. Details next.
Also, rights groups say thousands of children around the world have been recruited or abducted for use as soldiers. And according to the UN, humanitarian situation in South Sudan has deteriorated dramatically.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story in Kenya, seven officials from the doctors' union will be spending the next month behind bars for refusing to end the strike that has paralyzed the country's public health system for more than 2 months. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
After more than 2 hours listening to the doctor's lawyer on the progress of the talks between the union officials and the health ministry, High Court Judge Helen Wasilwa made her ruling. 1 month in jail.
Indeed, they have submitted that they are engaging in negotiations ordered by court on 1st December 2016, but they have not explained why they chose to obey part of the order and fail as officials of Kenya Medical Practitioner and Dentist Union to call off the strike as ordered by the same court.
The strike has paralyzed more than 2,500 public health facilities, leaving millions of Kenyans without access to medical care. But the KMPDU has insisted healthcare providers will not be cowed by threats of termination and arrest. The government and county governors have threatened to replace them with foreign physicians from Cuba and India. Kenyatta National Hospital Dr. Kevin Dede is one of the thousands of physicians on strike. He came to the court Monday in solidarity.
As long as our leaders serve their jail term, there will be no doctors going back to work, and there is no doctor who will engage in any negotiations with government. As long as the issues that doctors have raised are not being addressed, and clearly this jail sentence does not address those, it clearly does not solve the problem at hand.
The striking professionals say the government must fully implement a collective bargaining agreement signed in 2013. The agreement calls for the government to more than double their salaries. It also addresses concerns about the lack of adequate medical equipment in hospitals and poor security for medical staff. The Treasury says the government does not have the funds to fulfill the demands spelled out in the agreement. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The UN says the humanitarian situation in South Sudan has deteriorated dramatically due to what they call a devastating combination of conflict, economic decline, and climate shocks. Aid organizations are making a new appeal for $1.6 billion to help nearly 6 million people. However, they estimate about 7.5 million people in all are in need of humanitarian assistance and protection across South Sudan. Conditions have gotten worse since fighting erupted in December 2013. UN Humanitarian Coordinator for South Sudan, Eugene Owusu, says the country is facing unprecedented needs that will only increase in the months ahead.
Around the world, thousands of children have been recruited or abducted for use as soldiers. Rights groups lay the blame on government forces, militias, and rebel groups. The psychological scars that many of these children bear make it difficult for them to re-enter society or to trust government institutions. But a recent workshop in northern Uganda aims to change that. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
For years, Uganda's Gulu district was known for the abduction of thousands of kids by the Lord's Resistance Army. LRA rebels would come in the night to kidnap them, often killing their family members as they watched. The six-day workshop was held there at a secondary and vocational school in Kirindongo. The workshop brought together former child soldiers and children from both Uganda and South Sudan. They were youth leaders in their early 20s and older. The group, Education Above All, joined with actor Forrest Whitaker's Peace and Development Initiative to sponsor the workshop from February 6th through the 10th. King's College Law Professor Malia Malik is an advisor for Education Above All and designed the course outline for the workshop.
One was a syllabus about how the participants in the workshop from Northern Uganda and South Sudan could take ideas about making schools safe, and particularly the demilitarization of schools in South Sudan, how they could develop campaigns and take some of those ideas back to their own communities. And the second syllabus was to have a film discussion around a film called Sometimes in April.
Sometimes in April is a 2005 historical drama about the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Nearly 1 million Tutsi and moderate Hutu were killed in a matter of months.
So I used that film to have a discussion about the process in which societies use ethnic classifications and the way in which that develops into dehumanization and leads to extermination, really. So we sort of stopped the film and had a discussion about Rwanda.
The discussion centered on mechanisms used to find justice, like the International Criminal Court. Professor Malik says there were mixed reactions to the ICC.
I had a discussion with them about the recent controversies in Eastern Africa about withdrawal from the ICC that was discussed at the African Union recently. The youth leaders themselves had mixed feelings because on the one hand, they are really interested in being part of a system of global justice. But on the other hand, they were really skeptical about the role of the UN and what they see as being the inability to hold large powers accountable.
The workshop focused on leadership, peace building, and business skills.
I think it's very important for youth leaders in these two countries who were brought together in order to allow them to build bonds across national, ethnic, linguistic differences to understand the mechanisms of universal principles, not just universal legal principles, but universal ethical principles about how one lives together without allowing ethnic, cultural, linguistic differences to become the basis for violence.
Malik says the Ugandan and South Sudanese youth leaders who attended the workshop had different perspectives.
There was an interesting contrast between Northern Uganda on the one hand, which is in a post-conflict reconstruction phase, and South Sudan, which is still in an acute conflict stage. And what was very depressing and sad for me was to hear first-hand experience from the youth leaders in South Sudan that there's a substantial, from what they were saying, increase in recruitment into militias of children as the fighting has picked up in the last 12 months.
Malik calls education a human right. She says only by equipping children and young people with the knowledge they need to build a better future for themselves and their country can we start to rebuild and reconstruct communities. Actor Forrest Whitaker says young people who attended the workshop have been active peace builders for some time through the Youth Peacemaker Network program. He adds that they have already accomplished a lot for their communities. Whitaker began working with kids from conflict zones after hearing their stories while working on the film Last King of Scotland. He portrayed former Ugandan leader Idi Amin, a role for which he won a Golden Globe and an Academy Award. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Fifteen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on The Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Tensions are rising along the Zimbabwe-Mozambique border as reports of cattle raids increase. RENAMO, which had become an official opposition party after Mozambique's long civil war, has resorted to a guerrilla campaign against the government. Residents in Zimbabwe's eastern highlands say rebels are stealing their cattle for food. However, there are now reports that Zimbabwe herders have raided cattle in Mozambique in retaliation. The border area has suffered from drought, and cattle have died as a result, making those remaining even more valuable.
And donated fur coats are being used to help comfort rescue animals and children, playing a major role. Born Free USA and the Sommerhalder Foundation, two wildlife conservation groups, have collaborated for their first Give It Back campaign. The campaign gives kids ages 5 to 17 a chance to first learn about trapping animals for fashion. It then gave them an opportunity to repurpose fur clothing to help wild animals recovering from mistreatment and abuse. Adam M. Roberts is CEO of Born Free USA. He explained the importance of the campaign and how it will raise awareness to stop the abuse of wildlife worldwide.
Born Free USA, as part of our anti-fur, anti-trapping program, has started this collection called Fur for the Animals, where we're trying to get people to send us their used fur that we repurpose for wildlife sanctuaries to give orphaned and injured wildlife the comfort and care that they need. And we've now partnered with the Ian Sommerhalder Foundation to launch this Give It Back program, where they work with local school children around the country to help us in the Fur for the Animals program, collecting the fur, packaging it up, and delivering it to animals in need. So it's really a unique partnership between Born Free and Ian Sommerhalder's work to work with children to get them involved, both in learning about the cruelty behind the production of fur garments and the need to protect these animals that are so desperate for our care.
Why is it so important for children to learn this part of the lives that some animals live?
I think more and more we're starting to learn that children have an incredibly impactful presence in terms of policy, whether it's the government or corporations, just in the way that they approach life. So we've seen, for example, with circuses, I think, and zoos to a large part, that when kids start to decide there's animal cruelty behind the big top, then parents no longer want to take their kids to the circus. It's really what we do for our children that drives our decision-making in terms of, as I say, policy or corporate spending. And so similarly, in this instance, when you have kids speaking out against fur and the importance of protecting animals that have been rescued, it resonates, I think, not only with their peers, but with their parents as well. So the more we can get children growing up thinking that fur is objectionable and that only fur should be on live animals, not dead ones and worn by people, the more impactful that's going to be in terms of how society looks at fur and how companies look at fur.
What impact will this have on poaching and animal abuse on a worldwide level?
I think the more that we can have this sort of resonance at a local level, the more that will springboard into national and international impacts. So once we start, for example, having one program in a certain community in America where we're getting people of all ages literally involved, then that message is going to resonate throughout the state, throughout the country, and ultimately internationally. And as a result, we hope there will be a reduction in the trapping of fur bearers in the wild for their fur, and therefore less poaching, less cruelty, and more protection for animals in the wild where they belong.
Also, the children learned just how many animals it takes to make a fur coat. So what did they learn in that regard?
It's really astounding when you think about how many animals it takes to make a fur coat. And of course, it varies depending on the animal and the type of coat. You could have literally dozens of animals being killed just to make one fur coat. And that's something that, of course, the kids probably had not been exposed to previously. But then there's also the broader question, which I think is actually in some respects more prevalent in society today, about garments that have fur trim, where these fur companies are trying to bring back fur, not by making the old school full-length fur coat, but simply putting, for example, coyote fur around the collar of a hood or in the trim of a coat or boots. And so it actually takes just as many, if not more, animals to provide that fur trim than it does a full-length fur coat. So learning that it takes dozens and dozens of animals being slaughtered to provide these garments was really interesting for the children, something they hadn't seen before, heard before, and something that again spurs them to action because they're so horrified by that fact.
That was Adam M. Roberts, CEO of Born Free USA. He spoke with me from Washington.
President Donald Trump says his executive order closing U.S. borders to travelers from specific countries considered sources of terrorism will prevent attacks on American soil. Among forensic psychologists who study the motivations and backgrounds of mass killers, one leading authority says there are many factors apart from national origin that stimulate mass murderers. VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
Hold your candles for who we lost.
49 names, read at a vigil in Florida last year, identified the victims of the worst mass shooting in U.S. history, the slaughter at an Orlando nightclub. Children were among the 86 people killed in a murderous attack by a truck driver in Nice, France. 12 died in a mass shooting at the Navy Yard in Washington 4 years ago. Studies by the FBI, the Harvard School of Public Health, and others show the frequency of mass killings has tripled in the past few years. In the U.S., semi-automatic rifles are the killers' preferred weapons, but they also have used trucks filled with fertilizer, which can be detonated as a powerful explosive, as in Oklahoma City in 1995. In 2001, the weapons of terror were airplanes, commandeered by hijackers and deliberately flown into buildings in New York and Washington. J. Reed Malloy is a forensic psychologist who studies mass killings. He's also a professor of psychiatry at the University of California in San Diego. Malloy spoke to VOA via Skype.
But we find that these individuals typically have more in common than they do in terms of differences.
In an interview, Malloy said mass killers often have a history of psychiatric problems. They are mostly men. They have rocky, intimate relationships. And the killings are a quest for status, as in the Orlando nightclub shooting.
The individual also had some criminal background, and then he attempted to burnish, it appears, his reputation, perhaps inflate his notoriety by pledging allegiance during the mass murder itself to ideologically opposed groups, which was interesting in and of itself. He pledged allegiance to a Sunni group as well as to Hezbollah, which is Shia, and they, of course, have been at war for 1,300 years.
Malloy says even if killers claim to have a cause, that's not necessarily the reason for their actions.
Oftentimes, the pathway to violence begins with a personal grievance. And that grievance is typically has three components to it. One is there's some kind of loss. Secondly, there's the feeling of humiliation. And then thirdly, there's anger toward and blaming of a person or a group of people that have caused them to have this problem.
Malloy says access to weapons enables these attacks, but the prospect of gaining attention on social media is another important factor motivating them. Social media can make a despicable attacker infamous, and when others see these killings, sometimes live streamed on social media, they want to imitate them. Malloy says people who experience violence are more likely to become violent, and finally, he calls easy access to social media a bad omen for the future, when he expects to see more mass killings throughout the world. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Carol. As the Trump administration considers revising its executive order banning immigration from 7 mostly Muslim countries, debate continues over its effects. A federal appeals has blocked the order from taking effect, setting the stage for a legal battle over its merits. But the Trump administration could make some changes following the court's criticisms. Critics say the executive order would serve as a recruiting tool for Islamic State terrorists, but some reject that argument. Ambassador Alberto Fernandez is the former director of State Department Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi.
The reason I criticize it, I think, because it's a simplistic way of looking at things. First of all, it's not borne out by the facts. If you look at ISIS propaganda of why it does things, it doesn't do things because of a particular president or a particular foreign policy. It says over and over and over that its argument is existential. It is against the West. It is against the infidels. It is for a whole range of reasons, but not because somebody doesn't get a visa to go to the United States. That's a simplistic way of looking at it. It's also insulting to Muslims. The idea that Muslims are going to be so easily radicalized. I don't get a visa, I'm going to become a terrorist. This is ridiculous.
On what basis did you argue that 5 of the 7 listed countries on the temporary visa ban could be hard-pressed to meet any advanced visa threshold?
Well, the difference, if you look at the 7 countries, there are different ways of categorizing them. Some countries are on terrorism lists, some are not. You have Shia majority country, you have Sunni Arab countries. But there's another way of looking at it. And if you look at the 7 countries, 2 of them have resident U.S. embassies. So 2 of them have full diplomatic relations, despite all the challenges of those countries. So Sudan and Iraq are different than the other 5. The other 5 are countries where there is not a normal diplomatic relationship. Either there's not an embassy on the ground or they're unfriendly relations, as the case is, say, Syria and Iran. So that's the difference. That's why Sudan and Iraq could have an easier way.
You predicted that the one country most likely to be able to take steps on its own to satisfy the new administration's tough vetting and is quite motivated to do so is, ironically, the Islamic government of Sudan. Why?
First of all, Sudan has a long-standing security relationship with the United States, with U.S. intelligence, and has been an effective partner in counterterrorism with the United States for years now. So I think that that means that there is a kind of ongoing counterterrorism, ongoing intelligence cooperation, which bolsters the idea that Sudan should not be on the terrorism list and wants to cooperate with the United States. Also, Sudan, of course, has distanced itself from Iran and forged its relationship with friendly Arab governments like Saudi Arabia and others. So they're trying to change. That's pretty clear that they're trying to change and improve their relationship with the United States.
You served as a top diplomat in Sudan. How do you explain the fact that while the current government has a bad record in human rights and has been a long time international pariah, it has been in power now for almost 28 years?
I think the reason for its success is that they are successful in the most important thing that governments have to do. How do you stay in power? They have shown the ability to be political chameleons, to reinvent themselves when the facts suggest that they should do so. This is a government that once hosted bin Laden and is now a counterterrorism partner. This is a government that preached jihad against the infidel and then made peace with the leftist Christian Sudan People's Liberation Movement that led to the CPA and led eventually to the independence of South Sudan. So they are political chameleons, Islamists, but realists when it comes to power, the way power works in the world. That's why they've been able to survive.
Ambassador Alberto Fernandez is the former director of the State Department's Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Dan Crafton, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next on Let's Talk, love and Valentine's Day in America. Do you have a Valentine? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing love and Valentine. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.